Thank you, and thank you to the previous presenters. This has been incredibly useful for me, so I hope it's useful for others, and I really appreciate what the law section has accomplished in a really short time over the last couple of years. So what I'm going to be talking about, I have no relationships, and what I'm going to be talking about is the product of two projects funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, that beginning in October 2009, Preemption and Movement Building in Public Health, and essentially a continued and renewed version of the original project renamed Grassroots Change, Connecting for Better Health. And the first iteration of the project had a significant research component, which among other things, folks at Johns Hopkins, including Shannon Frateroli, played a very active, although albeit volunteer, role in. And now we've moved into more of a dissemination and educational mode at this point. And as the name implies, some of the first work we did focused on preemption and the relationship between federal and state preemption and the capacity of the public health field to grow effective grassroots movements. And we've moved to a somewhat broader scope of grassroots movement building, but with still focusing on the very significant impact and role that that preemption plays in grassroots movement building. And something very important that a number of people in this room actually played some role in occurred in 2011, which is the Institute of Medicine issued a report on entitled Revitalizing Law and Policy in Public Health. And among other things, for the first time, took a very important step in establishing a presumption against preemption, a federal or state preemption in public health and health policy. That was a fundamental shift. 5 or 6 years ago, there was nothing like that kind of consensus that under most circumstances in addressing most public health concerns that preemption, or what might be known in a more academic setting as sealing preemption, should be a presumptively a bad idea. So a group of us published an article that was a combination of a literature review of all of the work. There had been a lot of work that was issue-specific that had been done on preemption, like what is the impact of state preemption in alcohol prevention? What impact has it had that most states allow pretty limited regulation of alcohol marketing and sales at the municipal level? And then lots of literature on the impact of preemption and tobacco control and other issues. And we brought all that together, building on the IOM's recommendation. And I should go back and say both our work in this and the IOM's recommendation were universal. They weren't specific to one issue. And that was actually probably the fundamental breakthrough, saying that it doesn't matter if you're talking about tobacco or pesticide regulation. The negative consequences of federal or state preemption, again, from an academic point of view, what would be called ceiling preemption versus minimum standards or floor preemption, are not issue specific. That it's bad across the board, or the presumption is there. There are obviously exceptions, which we could talk about a little bit later. So we followed up that piece with a piece of original research. And again, this was the entire piece of research resulted from a recommendation from Shannon Frateroli at Johns Hopkins, who's done extensive research both on grassroots movement building in things like violence prevention and in terms of the fire service, but also specifically fire prevention and residential fire sprinklers. And so we conducted survey research on, we wanted to move beyond looking at preemption somewhat in isolation and devote some resources to learning more about grassroots movement building across public health and health policy. And our goal was to see if we could test some of our theories about the value of grassroots movement building across all of public health, that not issue specific. What I mean by that is that we can say with confidence that grassroots movement building in the smoke-free arena has been very successful over the last 25 years in adopting progressive and effective public health protections and defeating the tobacco industry, which is the primary opposition. What we wanted to do was see if these lessons and this guidance for the field was different from issue to issue, or if there were some universal lessons. So we conducted we did a literature review and conducted surveys with key informants, and looking at two issues. The first one being, has there been a grassroots movement for residential fire sprinklers, and what were the components of that movement? What were factors that were barriers to success? What were success factors? And then the related issue of was preemption a factor? So we set out, among other things, to learn as much as we could about residential fire sprinklers and the movement for residential fire sprinklers. So very briefly, because again, we were not so much looking at making a case for residential fire sprinklers because we feel others have made that, like the National Fire Protection Association, which was founded, as you'll see, 120 years ago. But we did want to start from that, from the point that this was a public safety or public health movement, and hence make the case that the objectives were pro-public health rather than against the public health. So residential deaths and injuries remain a problem, a very serious problem. There's been significant progress made by the fire service and others. While the numbers of those who are impacted directly by this are smaller than, for example, by alcohol-related problems or tobacco, the nature of these the deaths and injuries that were resulting from fires are often very expensive and very horrific from a human perspective as well as an economic perspective. On the other hand, in 1874, an effective sprinkler head was patented by a gentleman who was an industrialist, and voluntarily, of course, put them into his factories because that was where the focus was at that time. So in order to protect his workers and his investment, he patented and installed fire sprinklers in 1874. The NFPA was founded in 1896, really for a significant part of what they were doing at that, the reason for their being at that point was to get fire sprinklers into industrial facilities and other factories. Nonetheless, in 1911, I think, do people know about the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire still? So that was a turning point. It's often referred to as a turning point in industrial safety and labor, but it was also a turning point in the prevention of fires and specifically automatic fire sprinkler systems. 146 workers died in the fire. It was entirely preventable, primarily preventable by the installation of what was then a 30-year-old technology, the fire sprinklers, which were even at that point effective. They're more effective now, but they were pretty darn effective by the 1950s and 60s. You could really get an inexpensive and almost entirely effective system, either for a residence or for a factory. So in 1975, the NFPA published a technical standard that was specifically for one and two family homes and mobile homes. They'd been used in those environments before, but this was a standard that was designed both to guarantee efficacy but also to make, to guarantee, to infuse it with some economy as well. And then something again that a number of folks at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health contributed directly to with their research was the adoption by the International Code Council, which publishes the primary model codes that cities, counties, and states adopt. They in 2008 included a requirement in the model code, the IRC, that all new homes, whether they're apartments or condominiums or townhouses or single family homes, include automatic fire sprinkler systems. And so a lot of folks working on it at the time assumed that because historically when the IRC when a new provision enters the model code, it is a natural process by which municipalities and states adopt the code with that provision. That wasn't exactly the case here. That was an enormous accomplishment, and it's been essential to the success going forward. But something a little bit different and more complicated has happened. So going back then, that's fire sprinklers, that's the code. This is the movement that we learned about. And it was very helpful because although Shannon Frateroli and her colleagues, a number of her colleagues, are experts on this movement and knew about it already and have studied it, pieces of it, I knew nothing about it. I did not know that there were residential fire sprinklers, let alone a residential fire sprinkler grassroots public health movement before Shannon told me. So that was great because I was completely objective and was able to, and we learned from scratch. And this is what we learned in our research, among other things, that in 1978, San Clemente, California passed, and this is an interesting movement because some of the movements we look at could be characterized as being politically partisan to some degree, although I could argue with that. But this is an example of a movement that is quite clearly nonpartisan. San Clemente is not like where I'm from, which is Berkeley, for example, and this was 1978. It's a fairly conservative community, but they adopted an ordinance that said that every single home built in San Clemente going forward needed to include an automatic sprinkler system, including including single-family homes. And there was a movement building from the early 70s, and I've been blessed to be able to interview as one of the key informants, Ron Coleman, who's in California and was the chief in San Clemente when he proposed that the city council passed a sprinkler ordinance. And at the time that he did that, that he started that campaign in 1975 or 1976, he said to himself, how the hell is it we can protect factories and can't save 13-year-old children? He would find children, young people, who were killed in easily preventable home fires. While at the same time, there was a requirement that, for example, in his community, that there were a number of factories building fiberglass boats, and they all had residential fire sprinklers. So when he would respond to the other members of the fire service would respond to the frequent fires, chemical fires in the yachting industry, these fires would be put out within 10 minutes of having started because they had good, cheap, standard systems. But then he would come upon dead children in easily preventable fires, and that element of passion and commitment and personal stake is kind of a critical part of grassroots movement building. From there, a network of individuals who were connected by telephone and through meetings of the NFPA and others went forward and one by one passed these ordinances. Cobb County, Georgia, Scottsdale, Arizona, which became a model, there was Prince George's County. There were very good studies done in Scottsdale and in Prince George's County, when surprisingly, if Johns Hopkins was involved in the Prince George's County evaluation as well, because there's been a lot of work done locally in Maryland, statewide and in Maryland as well. And so this began to go from a series of committed fire service leaders at the local level into a movement. As it matured, it was primarily fire service, and the fire service remained in leadership and has remained to this day to be key leaders of this movement. But survivors, burn survivors, actively joined, some homeowners joined, environmentalists, because, for example, in California, but not just in California, there are concerns about fires and related issues and its impact on the natural environment, and home builders who don't want to get sued for fires that are clearly easily preventable, and the sometimes horrific injuries and in some cases deaths that result from those preventable incidents. So what we discovered in our research is that ultimately, as of November 2011, 368 local ordinances, most of them essentially identical, requiring fire sprinkler system installation in all new residential construction, had been adopted in 34 states. Again, illustrating the sort of nonpartisan nature of this grassroots movement, and I would argue many grassroots health and safety movements. These are not blue states or red states. These are just lots of states and lots of communities with representing probably the diversity of American political beliefs. As a result of that grassroots movement, we would argue, that is to say, the success at the local level, two states, Maryland, the home of Johns Hopkins University, and California passed statewide codes. But it was not until Maryland, communities in Maryland had passed, 31 communities in Maryland and 146 in California had passed local ordinances, and that illustrates the innovative power of local public health policy advocacy. I'm going to skip there's a handful here that are not essential, and I'm almost done. I would say, and this was not the largest part of our findings on this, we've done a lot of work on preemption, on its broad impact, the article that we published that I showed earlier in the Journal of Public Health Management and Practice, but really we were focused on the grassroots movement building piece with this piece of research. Nonetheless, preemption became a factor when Texas in 2009 passed statewide preemption of local residential sprinkler ordinances and codes, in spite of the fact that there were no local residential fire sprinklers ordinances in Texas. In other words, they preempted something that didn't exist preemptively. Wow. I'm sure I hope that was clear. And following that, 13 other states followed that. But the good news, and this is in the article. The article is open access on AJPH in the October issue on residential fire sprinklers, so it's free to download. 13 states passed preemption, and that may sound like a bad thing. The reality is the strength of the movement, starting in 1978 with Ron Coleman and the other members of the fire service, has been so great that I'm fairly confident that the passage of preemption, in this case, it's supported by the National Association of Home Builders, which is a trade association for large-scale home builders. I think it's not going to interfere with the tremendous work of the fire service, the NFPA, and the others who are involved in this. What I will say about the article is that we learned valuable lessons about building grassroots movements and confirmed our theory about preemption being a bad thing for grassroots movements. These are actually on the APHA website for this section, one-page document that summarizes our lessons for grassroots movement building. I won't go into these now because they're available. I'm happy to discuss them. And thank you very much for putting up with my five extra too many slides.